This is Tony Bersunas with Perfect Circle, Garlic and Grass exclusive interviews. Today we're speaking with David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. David Ray Griffin is professor of philosophy of religion at the Claremont School of Theology in California, where he has taught for over 30 years. He is the author and editor of more than 20 books, most of which have been on philosophical topics such as the problem of evil, evolution, and the mind-body problem. But with The New Pearl Harbor, Professor Griffin focuses his formidable mind on the historic events of 9/11. Since publication in March, The New Pearl Harbor has been acclaimed as the best investigative book on 9/11. No less a name than Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, upon reviewing it and re-examining the events of 9/11, called The New Pearl Harbor the most persuasive argument I have seen for further investigation of the Bush administration's relationship to the 9/11 attacks. I reached Professor Griffin by phone. Professor Griffin?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll just go ahead and get started. I found the book just about a month or two ago, and, really found it pretty amazing. You've written an amazing book. I think it's striking in both its fearlessness to go where no one else in the media seems to be going, and also in the calmness in which it asks such explosive questions. What do you think are the two or three biggest questions or problems with the official story about all of this?
It is hard to narrow it down to just two or three because I recently been asked many times, are there any smoking guns? And so I decided finally to write up a list of them, and I came up with a list of 40. So
40 smoking guns.
There are lots of major questions. Certainly, near the top of the list, at least, has to be the mere fact that on 9/11, standard operating procedures were not used. Certainly with regard to flights 11, 175 that hit the World Trade Center, and then at least according to the official story, flight 77, which was said to hit the Pentagon. But beyond that, there's the massive amount of evidence that the three buildings of the World Trade Center were not brought down by fire, as the official theory has it, but by controlled demolition. There is President Bush's behavior that day, which suggests that he and his Secret Service knew that they were not targets. And on and on and on. So there are quite a few.
And then, what the 9/11 Commission has come out and what they seem to say basically is that it was a sort of a classic case of unpreparedness. How does that sound to you?
Well, that is the official story, that we just were not prepared for any such thing. We were looking out, as in the old Cold War days, rather than looking inside. And of course, the 9/11 Commission itself has debunked most of what the White House had claimed by revealing the August 6th memo and other pieces of information that showed the administration had considerable warning about planes being used as terrorist instruments. And there are even more specific pieces of information that we know about that the 9/11 Commission has not raised. So they've been somewhat self-contradictory on this, but certainly they have supported the official view, which is that finally it all occurred because of a combination of incompetence and breakdown, whereas, of course, the alternative explanation is that it was not breakdown but stand down, and that is supported by the fact that although here you had dozens of people exhibiting extreme incompetence that led to the deaths of some 3,000 Americans, not a single person was fired, punished or even publicly reprimanded. So normally when there is that kind of incompetence, there are consequences. But here, if there were any consequences at all, the people were promoted.
Yeah, another thing is, you know, people have said, what I've heard is people saying it's odd that there were no fighter planes in the air during the hour or two that the planes were, you know, the planes were hijacked. And the question that I have and that people have asked me is that something, do you know that there were planes in the year before or the couple of years before 9/11 that were routinely intercepted, or was it really something that they had never done before?
Oh, not at all. Interception, as I point out in the book and many other authors have pointed out, is an extremely routine matter. Now, shooting down is not a routine matter because normally when planes are intercepted by two jet fighters, they do what they're told, and they follow the fighters to the nearest airport, and everything is taken care of. But interception itself has occurred about 100 times a year, so it's extremely routine. And yet, and also, it occurs very quickly, that normally the time that passes between the sign that an airplane was possibly hijacked, you know, it goes radically off course or they lose radio contact or the transponder's turned off, any sign like that, within a minute, the FAA controller notifies NORAD, that's simultaneously notifying the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon. NORAD has the assignment then of ordering jets scrambled from, set up from the nearest airport. And that normally takes another minute. And then, according to NORAD itself, jet fighters can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in 2.5 minutes. And then these jets, if they're F-15s, can fly at 1,850 miles an hour. So given the number of bases we have in the country, almost any plane would be intercepted within 10 to 15 minutes. And yet on 9/11, Flight 11, according to the official story, was known to be possibly hijacked at 8:14, and it did not hit the North Tower until 8:46. That was 32 minutes. And then with that warning, Flight 175 was known to be hijacked certainly by 8:42, and yet another 21 minutes went by before it hit the South Tower at 9:03. And then another very long time goes by, another 35 minutes, until whatever it was that hit the Pentagon hit it, and that was actually 42 minutes from the time that, according to the official story, the controllers saw it turn around and head back towards Washington. So these are extreme examples of not following standard operating procedures. In each case, if we work down the details of this story, you would see in each case either an FAA controller or someone at NORAD or the fighter pilots themselves, or maybe two or three of them, acted with unusual incompetence on that day, and as far as we know, only on that day. So what happened on 9/11 was extremely unusual.
I want to get back to the Pentagon, but first, you know, the things that you point out in the book in the New Pearl Harbor are so, I mean, as you say, there are 40 smoking guns and they're quite explosive. Why is it you think that there are not, you know, people in the streets just freaking out? You know, why isn't the media, you know, where is the media in all this? Why aren't there government officials that are sort of coming forward with these scandalous allegations?
Well, the lack of concern by evidently most of the population thus far is due, I would say, primarily to the fact that they have not been informed about these discrepancies by the mass media. So it is only those people who listen to alternative radio who learn about these things or who take the initiative to find stories on the internet or so on. But I find that as soon as people learn these very elementary details, they are appalled and they're extremely upset. And they, well, if you look at my the customer reviews on Amazon.com, we have almost 80 of them now, and many of them say an extremely frightening book, a very scary book. And when you think through the implications, that is a fair reaction. So I find that people are concerned once they know the discrepancies between the official story and facts that are rather readily available even from mainline sources. So the main scandal here is, besides the fact that 9/11, which was used as the basis for the Bush administration's war on terror, was perhaps the ultimate act of terrorism itself. Besides that possible scandal, the main scandal here is the failure of the mainline media, both print and television and mainstream radio, to inform people about these most elementary facts.
And with government officials, I mean, how many people do you think had to know about this? And are they, I mean, do we have just a huge sort of cadre of evildoers in our government? Or is, you know, to use the phrase that we hear attached to some of those in other countries?
This is a complex issue, but first of all, we need to distinguish between people who are in the military and people who are in other government services. We know that the military does instill a distinctive kind of discipline, and most people in the military are imbued with the ethic of obeying their superiors no matter what. Now, the Allies after World War II said that was not acceptable. We told the Germans just the fact that you were following orders did not excuse you. If you knew the orders were illegal and immoral, you should have disobeyed them. But we also know from accounts in various wars of our own, such as Vietnam and now Iraq, that subordinates generally believe that they are to do what their superiors tell them to do and not to think for themselves. Furthermore, they fear, and we have reports from this from previous stories, if one reads the history of American militarism and imperialism, that people are told rather forthrightly that it would be very dangerous for them to break the code of silence. And now, if we go beyond the military to people in the government, we also find that intimidation is used in their cases. And likewise, if they're members of the FBI and certainly the CIA and other intelligence agencies, they have taken an oath of silence. Again, there's a conflict between that and the more general moral duty not to do something illegal and immoral. But in most cases, this ethic that has been instilled in them, this institutional ethic, combined with the fear of losing their job and perhaps even being prosecuted, can keep most people silent. I think most of us can understand if someone said to you, well, you know, Tony, if you go and talk about this, we just will not be able to guarantee the safety of your family members. It's an implicit threat, but explicit enough that the person gets the point.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that people haven't come forward if indeed this was a massive, fairly massive conspiracy with with perhaps 100 people or so involved, because people generally come forward only when there is a public climate that induces this. And thus far, there has not been any such public climate. And in fact, the public climate has been to discourage people from coming forward. But if, for example, Thomas Kane, the chair of the 9/11 Commission, had gone on national TV and said to the American public, "We are looking into all possibilities here, including the possibility that 9/11 was allowed to happen because of government complicity by certain agencies of the U.S. government. And we want you to come forward if you know anything about this, and we will give you immunity and protection." Then maybe some people would have come forward, but obviously nothing like that, even close to that, has happened.
And Professor Griffin, what do you say to those who disagree with you, who say that this, I mean, even asking these questions in this time of war and terrorism is borderline treason?
Well, I have no patience with any accusation like that, because it is well known and well documented and something that is part of the American way of life, that dissent, the right to dissent, the right to question your own government officials, even the right to accuse them of crimes, these are fundamental rights. And when we're talking about the that what we're out doing is protecting the American way of life, we're not simply talking about protecting our riches and consumerism. We're most fundamentally talking about, or should be talking about, protecting our democratic freedoms with our civil and political rights. Now, if someone disagrees, on the other hand, with the idea that perhaps the government is complicit, then I have no problem with that whatsoever, because I do not even make that charge directly myself. My book only says that there are many pointers that seem to suggest government complicity, and that's what I mean by smoking guns. And when I speak more precisely, I call them prima facie smoking guns, things that appear to be smoking guns, but pointing out that only further investigation could reveal whether or not these things really do point to government complicity, or whether there's another explanation. So my book, as you know from reading the last chapter, is simply a call for a full investigation, and by that I mean one that does include investigating these more disturbing questions that seem on the surface to point to government complicity.
And absolutely, Professor Griffin, I completely support your what you're saying about what you're defending as our rights. And I do find in reading the book that it's admirably calm and it's admirably detached in a certain scientific way from making huge accusations. And it says what we need is an investigation. So what do you think that people that are going to be listening to this interview or reading this online, who either agree with you completely or agree with you in part, what can we do?
Well, in the first place, let me make clear that what I hope they will agree with me on is simply that if there are unanswered questions, disturbing questions, in fact, they need to be investigated. And I don't know how anyone could disagree with that. Now, once they've agreed with that, then there are a number of things they can do. And of course, I would hope they would read the book rather than simply judging this on the basis of this interview, because as I stress in the book, it is a cumulative argument. On the one hand, there's nothing original in the book in terms of facts. All I have done is really pull together and synthesize and organize the evidence that other researchers before me had had pulled out from the various sources. The only thing that is distinctive about the book is that I did pull those together and organize them in such a way that you can see a cumulative argument. That is, that any part relating to 9/11 that you look at shows that there are serious questions and discrepancies between the official account and the apparent facts. So whether you look at any of the four flights, whether you look at Bush's behavior that day, whether you look at the behavior of the FBI and other intelligence agencies prior to 9/11, or whether you look at those activities after 9/11 and the activities of the U.S. Army, the military in Afghanistan, the so-called hunt for bin Laden, all the way down the line, in every case you find out that there are these serious discrepancies. So it's when you start to see not just one or two problems, but a whole slew of problems, as I say, at least 40 major problems, then you start to see it looks like there's a pattern here, and that's what's most disturbing. So I would hope people would first of all investigate this for themselves and see if they find that that is indeed the case. Then if they do that and decide that there is at least sufficient basis for suspecting government complicity, then they should demand that there be a new investigation, assuming that what comes forward from the 9/11 Commission is not going to surprise us all and go far beyond what they've suggested thus far. And so this would mean writing letters to the editor, writing to their congresspeople, joining groups that are involved in investigating this. There's a new umbrella organization called 911truth.org. And get involved in this community, and in that way one learns all sorts of new things that that can be done.
And what do you make of some of the other events that happened shortly after 9/11? You know, there were the anthrax attacks, and then, you know, it was a year later, there was the odd crash of Senator Paul Wellstone's airplane. What do you make of those events?
They are certainly odd, and I think both demand more investigation than there seems to have been thus far. But these are not issues that I entered into in the book, so I won't speak about them here.
Okay, the last thing I was going to say is that it appears that that this book is a bit of a departure for you personally. Do you think so? And if so, was there a special inner or outer reason you personally wrote this book?
If one looks at my previous writings, this certainly looks like a tremendous divergence in that I've written books in the philosophy of science and straight philosophy, such as the mind-body problem, and philosophy of religion, dealing with such questions as the problem of evil and life after death and evolutionary theory and creation and so on. On the other hand, doing the research for this book wasn't so different, because in each of these cases what you have is a massive amount of evidence that is relevant to the question. You have generally an orthodox theory. That is the dominant view. And then you have one or more unorthodox, perhaps even heretical hypotheses. And it's a matter of looking at all the relevant evidence and seeing which of the various hypotheses, if any, can account for the relevant evidence the best. And so in that sense, that's what I have done in this book. And this is not so different from dealing with the question of evolution or the mind-body problem or, say, the problem of evil.
It's a wonderful book, and I almost see you more in the tradition of Thomas Paine, who is bringing out some uncomfortable truths in a time of political need, and I think it's a great book, and it's at an important time, and I really do hope that everyone who reads this finds it intriguing enough, at the least, to go out and take a look at the book. So I want to thank you, Professor Griffin, for talking with me today.
Well, you're welcome, and I like that comparison because it really doesn't require a lot of sophisticated knowledge to do this, but simply common sense, which Thomas Paine talked about.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome.
This is Tony Bersunas, and you've been listening to Full Circle, an exclusive Garlic and Grass interview with David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. Thank you for joining us.